You're listening to Humanities Viewpoints, a podcast from the Humanities Institute at Wake Forest University. I'm your host, Assistant Director Amy Meppam. This month's episode marks the first Roundtables episode of Humanities Viewpoints, in which a group of Wake Forest faculty gather to discuss a topic from the lens of their respective fields. Today, our topic is Familiar Prejudices from Unexpected Sources. Our conversation includes discussions of anti-Greek sentiments in Roman satire, ancient Greek and Roman anti-Semitism, women's involvement in the second era Ku Klux Klan, imagined histories, and the rhetoric of the 2016 presidential campaign. My guests are T.H.M. Geller-Goad, Jeffrey D. Lerner, and Lynn S. Neal. T.H.M. Geller-Goad is Assistant Professor of Classical Languages at Wake Forest University. He specializes in Latin poetry, especially the funny stuff, Roman comedy, Roman erotic elegy, Roman satire, and, if you believe him, the allegedly philosophical poet Lucretius. Jeffrey D. Lerner is a professor of history at Wake Forest University. His research focuses on the Hellenistic period in the East. He teaches a variety of courses on ancient history, including History 312, Jews, Greeks, and Romans. Lynn S. Neal is a scholar of American religious history. She is the co-editor, with John Corrigan, of Religious Intolerance in America and the author of a number of articles on religious intolerance, including Christianizing the Klan, Alma White, Branford Clark, and the Art of Religious Intolerance, The Ideal Democratic Apparel, T-shirts, Religious Intolerance, and the Clothing of Democracy, and They're Freaks, the Cult Stereotype in Fictional Television Shows, 1958 to 2008. She is associate professor and associate chair in the Department for the Study of Religions. You can find a list of the readings and sources my guests draw from during this discussion below in the podcast description, and also at humanitiesinstitute.wfu.edu/podcast. I hope you enjoy our conversation. So I just wanted to thank everyone for being here today. This is the first episode of Humanities Viewpoints Roundtables. I'd like to just briefly introduce my guests, Ted Geller-Goad from Classical Languages, Jeffrey Lerner from History, and Lynn Neal from the Department for the Study of Religions. Our topic today is Familiar Prejudices from Unexpected Sources. What I'd like each of you to do is talk for a couple of minutes about a moment from your particular field, and give you each a few minutes to talk about that, and then hopefully we'll open up the conversation to talk about some of the connections that we might find as the conversation proceeds. So,
all right. So most people might not be familiar with the term Orientalism, which was a theory developed by the political scientist Edward Said, but everyone's familiar with it in practice. An easy historical example is Western Europeans in the 15th and 16th and 17th centuries looking eastwards and seeing the Ottoman Empire and seeing China, seeing the mysterious and exotic and lavish and degraded, degenerate, decadent East, and looking to the West and seeing the Americas and seeing the uncivilized, uncouth savages. And this is familiar in modern media as well. You can think about the Disney movie Aladdin. I think that says it all. But you can also think about the TV show 24 and the portrayal of Middle Easterners and of Muslims. And you get the idea of looking east and seeing an older and more corrupt and decadent civilization. The area where I'd like to point out that is this familiar prejudice from an unexpected source is in the Roman satirist Juvenal, who was writing in the 110s, 120s CE. And his third satire, The Savage City, is one of his most famous satires. It's all talking about how bad Rome is these days and how terrible it is to live there. It was imitated by Samuel Johnson in his satire on London. Here, in addition to a variety of other kinds of prejudices, the speaker presents a prejudice of a Roman against a Greek. And you don't normally think about Romans thinking of Greeks in this Orientalist mindset, thinking of the Greeks as the Eastern Other. But in this poem, you get just that. Early in the poem, the speaker says, "My fellow citizens, I cannot stand a Greekified Rome." And he has many critiques of the Greeks, including that they are sexually promiscuous, but his primary critique is that they are inauthentic. The whole nation is a comic troupe. If you laugh, he is shaken with a louder fit of laughter. If he spots his friend in tears, he weeps without being sad. If you're cold, he's shivering. If you're hot, he sweats, and so on and so forth. And so what's interesting about this is that the Romans, who are often tied together with the Greeks in our thinking, you know, we talk about the Greco-Roman wrestling, Greco-Roman culture, all these sorts of things. The Romans do have a thread in their thought, in their literature, in their society of looking to Greeks and seeing this is the older, more sophisticated, but more corrupt and decadent civilization.
Well, my topic concerns ancient Greek and Roman anti-Semitism, which as a form of racism stemmed from observations that Greeks and Romans made about the cultural and religious attributes of the Jews, beginning with their conquest by Alexander the Great and continued throughout the duration of the Roman Empire. This largely came about because the Greeks defined the Jews from a Greek point of view. This practice led to stereotypes because the Greeks wrote for other Greeks in terms that would be understandable to them. At first, Greeks appreciated Jews, and Jews were flattered and accepted these stereotypes because the Greeks regarded them as philosophers. But later, after the Greeks were conquered by the Romans, the Greeks perceived the Jews as misanthropes. Part of the reason for this change was due to a tension that arose about their respective cultures. Judaism was rooted in Mosaic law and provided a Jewish sense of superiority because monotheism can be expressed politically as a form of monarchy, while the Greeks regarded their language and culture as the foundation of their superiority. Now, throughout the period of Greek domination, the Jews and Greeks lived in relative peace. But all this changed when the Romans conquered the Greek successor kingdoms of Alexander the Great. At first, the Jews welcomed the Romans, but over time, the Romans became increasingly seduced by Greek culture, despite the best efforts of individuals like Juvenal. To put things somewhat glibly, the Romans tended generally to believe the anti-Semitism of the Greeks. Even though there were some Romans who found Judaism so appealing that they converted, this aroused fear in other Romans, which was expressed through anti-Semitic slurs and even policies directed against the Jews.
All right, so now we need to jump ahead at least over 1,000 years historically, and we'll see that these familiar prejudices continue in some different forms, but some of the rhetoric remains the same. My sources concern the Ku Klux Klan, which was reorganized in 1915 at Stone Mountain, Georgia. And while many think of the Klan as a Southern organization, very quickly this group became national in scope. Some scholars estimate that its membership exceeded 5 million people. And to spread their ideas, they held rallies and parades, as well as working to influence local and national elections. And they were successful. In 1924, the Klan was able to elect a number of its members to political office across the country. So my source, The Ku Klux Klan and Prophecy, comes from this era and demonstrates how Protestant Christianity permeated this organization. Through biblical interpretation, Klan members promoted specific ideas about race, as my colleagues have just mentioned, as well as promoting anti-Catholic and anti-Semitic ideas.
After establishing these moments, if you could just talk for a few minutes about your approach to the subject matter and what you found surprising about it.
Well, I'll say that the anti-Greek sentiment in Juvenal is surprising because primarily of Rome's cultural inheritance from Greece. Horace, the famous Roman poet, put it best by saying, "Greece, after its capture, captured its savage conqueror and brought the arts into rustic Italy." It's almost impossible to talk about Roman culture without talking about Greek influence, and the Greeks are, for the Romans, generally sort of the senior sibling in their cultural thinking, especially when it comes to literature, and so having this anti-Greek sentiment pop up in Roman literature is what I found most surprising about it.
The aspect that I found most surprising with my topic is, who knew the Greeks and Romans were anti-Semitic, mm-hmm. right? Who even knew that the Greeks and Romans even knew there were Jews? And there's 900 other questions that come up from this as well. But I think the bottom line that continues to surprise me is that we find giants like the Roman historian Tacitus were anti-Semitic. He believed all of the negative stereotypes about the Jews made by the Greeks and the Egyptians. For example, the charge that Jews are lazy, maybe this originated from their observation of the Jews practicing Sabbath. He regarded Jews as deliberately perverse because they made profane whatever others regarded as sacred. And there's a whole litany of other charges as well. Misanthropy, contempt of other religions, blood libel. Blood libel is the false allegation that Jews murdered Greeks, especially Greek children, which is a charge of ritual murder. And later on, Christians will make the same accusation against Jews, but, of course, Jews murdering Christian children during Passover, Pesach. And we even find there are other examples made by other historians like Dio Cassius that the Jews of Cyrene, modern-day Libya, killed Greeks and Romans, then ate the flesh of their victims, made belts of their entrails, anointed themselves with their blood, and wore their skins for clothing. All this surprises me.
I don't know how to follow that. Yeah. I think the most surprising thing about my source is perhaps not the overt violence of it, but the embedded violence of it, or what Alma White called bloodless warfare, which I think is an interesting contrast perhaps to some of the other sources that we'll look at today, or maybe a point of continuity. The most surprising thing, though, about my source is that it's by a woman. At least that's what shocked me. When you look at statistics on hate crimes and membership in hate organizations, you predominantly find white men. However, given the popularity of the Second Era Klan, I think it makes sense that women were on its membership rolls. So the woman who wrote this book and two others, her name was Alma White, provides a window into this world of women being involved in hate organizations and religious intolerance. Yet we're left asking, who was she? Why did she promote these intolerant views? And in some ways, Alma White was, this is shocking, because she was a feminist and a visionary. She left Methodism over the organization's refusal to ordain women. She founded her own denomination. She saw potential in technology and was an early adopter of the use of radio to spread her religious message. She built two colleges, established a publishing house. She was quite an accomplished woman for her time. But yet this same woman who defended women's rights and the right to vote also publicly endorsed the Ku Klux Klan and wrote three books that explain how God had raised up this white-robed army to defeat Catholicism and Judaism. Her writings consistently frame the Klan as a Christian army defending America from these internal and dangerous enemies. She defines and consistently refers to Catholicism as the Scarlet Mother, a heretical religion that poses a political threat to the United States as it sought to overturn the separation of church and state, as well as, in her mind, remove the Bible from public schools. So Alma White's books also condemn Jews for not assimilating, for allying themselves with Catholicism, and for corrupting America with the movies.
Let's turn the conversation to what I think is already starting to emerge, some of the connections between noticing these moments. Maybe let's start with the handling of your sources, your distance or closeness from them, and maybe some emotional responses you might have in relation to them.
Well, I think my fascination with Alma White started, as I said, with this kind of conundrum in dealing with gender and religious intolerance that really hasn't been talked about by scholars. And I think the other thing were the visual images of the book and dealing with images that show Jesus with Klansmen as disciples distributing the five loaves and that kind of the shock value of such an illustration. Mm-hmm. And then for me, it takes me to a very powerful and popular, well-known piece in the study of religion by Jonathan Z. Smith, who wrote The Devil in Mr. Jones. He wrote it in the early 80s, 4 years after the events of Jonestown, and he was looking for sources and scholarly studies of the events at Jonestown, where over 900 people died in the name of religion, and he couldn't find anything. And he thought, this is not the job of the academy. We need to study these things. So he uses this phrase and returns to this phrase, nothing human is foreign to me. So I think for me, that echoes in my mind as part of my challenge to deal with these sources and not turn away from them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when he says nothing human is foreign to me, he is quoting one of the most famous lines from the Roman comedic playwright Terence. He's decontextualizing it because in context it's a busybody using this line, nothing human is foreign to me, as an excuse to get involved in his neighbor's business. But there's an interesting flip side in Juvenal is that here I think rather than the images being surprising, they're sort of familiar to the Roman eye. By the time you get to Juvenal, there has been a thread of Greeks as sort of tricksy little fellows. The Romans have a verb peregrikari, which means to Greek it up or really to really like waste your money on frivolous and sensual pleasures. And in Roman comedy, such as what Jonathan Zee Smith is quoting when he says, nothing human is alien to me. In Roman comedy, which is an adaptation of Greek comedy, the people presented are often engaged in low status behavior, and the more Greek a character is, the more likely he's going to be mocked within the comedy.
Well, I think one of the most difficult aspects about looking at subjects like these is the notion of objectivity and subjectivity. In part because I don't believe that subjectivity, it's difficult to remove oneself from the subject itself and be objective. There's only degrees of subjectivity. It's difficult to maintain a balance with reason and not allowing emotion to go unchecked when looking at something like anti-Semitism, for example. I'm not able to remove myself in such a way as to present, let's say, a scholarly discourse. If I was talking about modern American history, like Lynn can,
right.
I can't do that. I would make for a poor modern historian. I would get too emotional.
Right.
It's difficult enough for me, I found, to maintain a balance looking at people who lived and events that took place thousands of years ago, let alone something that is contemporary.
Right.
I'd say that the notion of subjectivity versus objectivity is a really difficult one, an elusive one to get at in Roman satire, because when we hear this or read this critique of daily life in Rome, and especially Greek influence in Rome, is that Juvenal's thoughts? Well, no, because it's all spoken by a character named Umbricius, Mr. Shady, in the poem itself. Well, is the person who's introducing and giving the stage to Umbricius, is that Juvenal? Well, no, that's the narrator of the poem whose name is Juvenal, but who doesn't overlap 100% with the historical author, about whom nothing is known outside of the text and maybe a couple of references in later texts. And so this notion of Juvenal the author versus Juvenal the narrator makes it really difficult to piece apart what we're supposed to believe or be persuaded by or adopt as our own thinking, and what is being put out there for our literary entertainment or to trick us or challenge us or to make us grapple with other points of view that are perhaps rancid to our own thinking.
Each of these moments we're talking about ideas of religion and nativism. Where in this do you find your work? What questions is your work grappling with in those terms?
Well, traditionally there are three historical developments of anti-Semitism in European thought. By looking at the Greeks and the Romans, that represents the first stage in the sense that they express their anti-Semitism based strictly on what they observe. They're not going to sit down and read the Bible. Right? They're just going to watch how Jews go about observing their religion. A second stage is Christian anti-Semitism, which is based largely on religious doctrine. And then the third came about in the beginning of the Enlightenment, when the notion of anti-Semitism spilled over into what we would call racial anti-Semitism, which of course culminated with the Nazis and still persists today, the Ku Klux Klan, the neo-Nazis, and so on. The difficulty for historians is not to become so emotionally entangled with these events that we lose our sense of place, we lose our sense of reason, so that we're unable to understand how the beliefs of the people we are studying are a reflection of a particular time and place.
for Alma White, religion is inseparable from her view of the Ku Klux Klan. So I think the desire might be to create a certain kind of distance between ourselves and our views about religion, and perhaps to protect the category of religion as something good, moral, and decent. But what we see in Alma White and in the second era Klan in particular is an inability to do this, that religion has often been used for uncivil ends and for violence. And to study this is to see how they're entangled with one another. So Protestant Christianity was a vital part of the second era Klan and why it succeeded. And one way Protestants distinguished themselves from Catholics and Jews was through their use of the Bible, through sacred texts. So for Alma White, the Bible contained enduring types, patterns that could be applied to the present circumstances that she saw around her. So she can very easily move between Bible and history and see Klansmen as biblical figures, and then her enemies and elevate them to these cosmic statuses and these endow them with these very threatening characteristics. So you see the Jew presented as Jonah, and he's indigestible in the whale or in the big fish, and he, which represents his stubbornness, his inability to assimilate and to become part of the American experiment. In the same way, she can do on the flip side, call upon the biblical Gideon, who battles idolatry in the book of Judges, and see the present day Ku Klux Klan members as Gideons battling Catholicism and saving America from this enemy.
I think that this religious connection is really important when thinking about the other. When the Romans look east to the Greeks and beyond, and they see this older, more decadent civilization, they also often fixate on what they view as bizarre religious practices. A good example is a poem by Catullus that dramatizes a man named Attis, a young man who participates in the ultimate act of devotion to the great goddess Cybele, who is a Eastern and then Greek goddess that finally comes to Rome, and the Romans are always viewing her as a foreign goddess. And this final act of devotion involves castration and the change of Attis from getting masculine adjectives in the Latin to feminine adjectives. And this is not as prominent in Juvenal's poem, but there's still some sense that Greeks have odd practices, including odd religious practices, compared to the Romans. And this really matches what you can see in nativism throughout history, including in our present moment, where the anti-immigrant sentiment in our current presidential campaign has taken a particular anti-Muslim cast and an anti-Semitic cast, and it's the least on the surface here, but you can pretty much see in the anti-Latino stance some anti-Catholicism as well, which matches very well with what you're seeing in the text of Alma White about the Ku Klux Klan and prophecy.
I think a lot of what these topics have in common is the question of how do many people who are not related and do not necessarily share any commonalities live together in peace. And this is something that I think has been going on since civilization began, literally. In terms of, let's say, the Jewish situation in antiquity, in the year 41 AD, the Roman Emperor Claudius issued an edict regarding the Jews living in the city of Alexandria. Alexandria, Egypt, the same Alexandria founded by Alexander the Great. A few years earlier, the Jews in the city, some of whose families had been living there for over 300 years, underwent the first recorded pogrom in history, in which Greeks slaughtered Jews in the city. And the Jews appealed to the Roman emperor for help, for resolution. Claudius's edict that came out, I think, surprised the Jews, to say the least. On the one hand, he upheld that the Jews had every right to practice their religion without fear of persecution. But because they practiced Judaism and they identified themselves as Jews, they could not become citizens of Alexandria. Only Greeks, that is, only pagans could be. And what's so interesting is that Jews living there and elsewhere around the empire found themselves as stateless people. And this idea of, let's say, a lack of citizenship extended throughout the Middle Ages and in some cases still exists today. For example, in Russia, you cannot be a Russian Jew. You can be a Russian or you can be a Jew, but there is no such thing as a Russian Jew except in the United States.
What Jeff is getting at with this difficulty of people to live with one another is a struggle with cosmopolitanism that is particularly acute in the city of Rome at this period. I think what you see in Juvenal's third satire is this speaker, Umbricius, Mr. Shady, wants to make Rome Rome again, but he's trying to get Rome back to a place in the past that never existed. It's an imaginary history that he's going back to. If we go back to that famous quote of Horace, Greece, after its capture, captured its savage conqueror and brought arts into rustic Italy. That rusticness is a fictional time long ago when Rome was Rome and the Romans were a simple, hard life, hard working people. It's often referred to as the Saturnian Age, the Age of Saturn in Roman literature and Roman thinking. And there's a parallel here. The Romans are thinking back to their past and seeing what a lot of American colonists saw in the noble savage when they were looking west. There's an Orientalist component to this rejection of modern Roman cosmopolitan in Juvenal's text that I think mirrors a lot of what you see in Alma White's anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism.
Yes, I'll pick up on that. And just talk about, which ties with Jeff's points as well, in the sense of in the struggle to figure out how to live together or how to maintain what your view is of a good society that often involves appeals to the past, to whether these are imagined pasts or real historical events. And for Alma White, it becomes much more an imagined past, but for her, very much based in ideas of history, because she viewed the Bible as a historical text that recounted a particular history, but then also became a type for interpreting all of history. So she could very easily construct a narrative to defend the actions and the ideology of the Klan through her appeals to the Bible, but also to her appeals to early American heroes. So she can depict Klansmen as biblical figures, but she's also going back to the American past and to this imagined unity and an imagined golden age where right prevailed and Protestant Christianity ruled, which we know was never quite that simple. But in doing so, she portrays members of the Revolutionary War, its heroes, as Klansmen, as representing these same principles and ideals, these values, and therefore using history as a way to demonstrate a particular heritage of the Klan and therefore enhance its supposed authority, authenticity, and legitimacy.
Do we want to talk any further about the fictional versus the historical past? I mean, there's so much to say about that.
The Jews are the biggest losers in history, and they break one of the cardinal rules of history, which is only the winners write history. Because they and not the losers survive. And what's fascinating about the Jewish experience is that they still exist as a people. They've survived Greeks and Romans and many others before them. They survived the Europeans of the Middle Ages. They survived modern Europeans, the Nazis and so on. And they still write history. It's almost as though they have the last word. There was an Egyptian priest named Manetho who lived 3rd century BC. And he wrote a history of his country in Greek. And it was for other Greeks. And at the time, there was a cultural competition between Egyptians and Jews to see who would have second highest status under the Greeks. he wrote at a time when Egypt was ruled by the Ptolemies, and the Ptolemies were a dynasty founded by one of Alexander the Great's generals. And part of his history of the Jews living in Egypt dealt with why the Jews left Egypt in the first place. The Jews, from their point of view, left because Pharaoh was bad and all these rules were broken. From the Egyptian point of view, the Egyptians, through Manetho, claimed that the Jews were kicked out of Egypt, not that they fled or left on their own volition. They left because, as Manetho says, they are a disease-ridden people. They suffered from all kinds of diseases like leprosy and others. They were kicked out because the Egyptians were afraid of being infected by them. This is the kind of situation, the kind of clash that we see. It's not always, when we talk about syncretism and assimilation and fusion and merging of different peoples, we have a tendency to gloss over it and see it as something very like veneer, very smooth and beautiful, but it's not always the case. Sometimes violence, it comes about because there were violent acts. People died because of ideas.
Mm-hmm. I would add, I was just thinking about what Jeff said about who writes history and winners and losers. And one thing I think is important to think about in these moments of familiar prejudices from unfamiliar places is the use of the language of winning and losing or victimhood. And what you see with Alma White in particular and the Second Era Klan is these are people who are not marginalized, but yet they feel intensely marginalized to such an extent that they are rallying, they're committing acts of vandalism, acts of violence, using the legislative and the political system to their advantage. But yet these are the people, if we look back historically, that had all of the advantages to be a Protestant white Christian in the 1920s was to be in a position of more privilege than most. And so her use of the language of victimhood and her valuing of women's experience and her use of gender as a tactic portrays herself as a victim of not only this religious threat, but of the gendered sexism of those around her. So she's advocating for convents to be opened and legislation because, women are being persecuted behind convent walls and we can't see it and it's invisible. But I think the moral authority of victimhood and the legitimacy that gets her is an important thing to think about when we think about the uses of history and that language.
Jeff also identified this pattern that cultural competition, say, between Jews and Egyptians can easily turn into cultural chauvinism, where one culture is presented as better, or rather more often, another culture is presented as deficient in some way. And you see this in Roman thinking about all kinds of non-Romans, but especially in Juvenal Satire 3 about Greeks. And this makes an easy step from cultural chauvinism and the corresponding cultural supremacy into patriotism or nationalism, particularly populist, xenophobic nationalism and patriotism, the kind that sort of isn't so much about let's make our place better as it is let's, make our place like it was before all these bad people got in. And the thing that I find really interesting is in each of these, there is a vulnerability as well as a privileged victimhood, because at least some parties in these sort of unpleasant, prejudicial trends, developments, feel like they are in a weakened position or a vulnerable position. So the speaker in Juvenal Satire presents himself not just as a good, upstanding Roman, but also as a poor urban resident. And he says, you have to be rich to get sleep at Rome because all the poor neighborhoods are noisy. He talks about how expensive it is. He talks about how Roman taxes go to pay for expensive government slaves. That one might be a little hard to relate to 20th century, but not to the 19th century America. And he says, this is a poor man's freedom. When he's been beaten and treated like a punch bag, he can beg and plead to be allowed to go home with a few teeth left. And I think it's this view back to a fictional historical past that where you were on the top, and now you're no longer on the top because you're struggling to get by, because things are harder now than they were before. I think this explains at least the appeal and the sort of flash flood-like growth of nationalism, chauvinism, patriotism, and nativism in all three of these contexts.
It's very difficult for me to hear that and not want to say, then can we talk about today in the current political rhetoric? I hear what you're saying, Ted, and can't help but think, who could you be talking about? Not to get too overtly political in this space.
Well, to get too overtly political, I can say that Donald Trump seems more like a juvenilian character than like a real person a lot of the times. A lot of the things he says would fit perfectly with the dispossessed, bigoted, and vulgar speaker of juvenile satires, and also Umbrageous in this one specifically. Juvenal, in the first poem of his collection of satires, says that his indignation is the source of his poetry. And I think that says a lot about the 2016 campaign season.
I just want to maybe jump off of Ted just
a little bit.
Yeah,
we can go back. Yeah.
And then we can go broader. But
sure.
What I think is interesting, your comments just made me think about when Trump's campaign first began, I was asked to talk to a reporter from the LA Times about putting or locating Trump in a larger history of religious intolerance. And it was very interesting because I have co-edited this whole volume on religious intolerance in the United States. And it's very easily to see the parallels of this present rhetoric with what has gone before. And so I think it makes sense. And if you don't know this history, you don't know that.
Right.
And I think that's an important reason why I worked on that book. And I think that's also a reason why we are here. And it's a past and a part of our history as a nation that we're not often taught in the public schools. And it's not a rhetoric that is fun to study. It's kind of that ugly side of our history, and textbooks make it pretty or make it veneer. They make it smooth. And there are reasons for that that are not all bad, but perhaps given the present climate, more knowledge about the way this rhetoric works. And what it does is we see these patterns of accusation, these patterns of religious intolerance and different types of intolerance repeat over time. And so knowledge of this, I think, is a valuable thing that helps us be better citizens and better interpreters of the rhetoric.
If we were to look at Europe and talk about anti-Semitism, if we were to look at the United States and fixate on racism, racism takes different manifested forms in the U.S. I think in both cases, both in Europe and the United States, we would find that in the European situation, there would be more self-identified anti-Semites, and in the United States, more self-identified racists than there are Europeans or Americans who like ballet, which one could argue is part of the civilization in each place. And unfortunately, it makes a phenomenon like what's going on with the Republican Party, arguably starting with Richard Nixon, understandable. Unfortunate, but very much a part of who we are and how we identify as a people. What makes Trump so ubiquitous is the fact that what he says comes right out of our own history. He's not saying anything unique. It's not anything new. It's not anything that we haven't heard before, except coming from a presidential candidate. That's what's new. But nothing else is. And certainly we've had a long tradition of keeping people out of this country who the majority in the country, or at least those with the loudest voices, felt posed a threat, whether it was Irish or Italians or Jews, and so on and so on. Now, it's just, it happens to be most recently Hispanics and Muslims.
Well, this gets to something that one theory of satire uses as the explanation for why satire exists. This scholar named Frederick Bogle published a book in 2001 called The Difference Satire Makes. And his basic claim, which I find persuasive at least as one way of approaching satire, both ancient and modern, not just the Roman genre, but the more broad what satirists do kind of thing, is to identify something in your society that is dangerously similar and use satire to satirize that thing or that person to make them different, to make a difference. That's what this different satire makes means, is to find something close to you and to distance it from you to protect yourself. We see this in a very unseemly way in Juvenal, where the people who are dangerously similar to the Roman speaker are anyone other than Romans, and the cultural supremacy of Rome has to be protected by mocking and insulting and marginalizing people who in Rome were pretty much already marginalized because they weren't Romans. In the modern world, there is plenty of this kind of satire that is used, I think, for bad purposes, or at least we could say for anti-cosmopolitan purposes. But there's also some really important difference-making that satire does. And I'd point to The Daily Show of Jon Stewart and to Samantha Bee's new TV show Full Frontal, where they're engaged primarily in media criticism. It's not because the media is dangerous, but what they use media criticism to do, their specific kind of media criticism, is satirizing false equivalency. When you treat the two major party nominees this year as equally bad, equally political, equally flawed, you are doing a disservice to truth. And media criticism that in the form of political satire, especially as you see it now in Samantha Bee, is creating this difference that exists in reality but doesn't exist in the mainstream media bubble, and is using the difference that satire makes towards the end of truth and of trying to protect American civil democracy.
I think that's a good place to conclude.
That was T.H.M. Geller-Goad, Jeffrey D. Lerner, and Lynn S. Neal on Familiar Prejudices from Unexpected Sources. You can find this and other episodes of Humanities Viewpoints at humanitiesinstitute.wfu.edu/podcast, or find us in the podcast section of iTunes. Thanks for listening.